Ever noticed how a toddler can ask why 100 times in a row? Yet as adults, we rarely question our own beliefs. Adam Grant's Think Again arrives as a timely antidote to our era of polarization and certainty. The book has garnered praise from thought leaders like Daniel Kahneman and Malcolm Gladwell, who calls it an urgent read in today's divisive world. Since his 2021 release, it's become a cultural touchstone, appearing on Barack Obama's reading list and inspiring millions to reconsider their approach to knowledge. The book's central premise, that intelligence is not about how much we know, but about how we respond when we don't know, resonates deeply in our information-saturated age. Grant, an organizational psychologist at Wharton and host of the popular Work Life podcast, doesn't just tell us to rethink, he demonstrates why it might be the most valuable skill we can develop in a rapidly changing world. When smoke jumper Wagner Dodge found himself and his crew trapped by a rapidly advancing wildfire in Mann Gulch in 1949, he made a counterintuitive decision. Instead of continuing to run uphill with his team, he lit an escape fire that burned the grass in front of him, creating a fuel-free zone where he could safely lie down as the wildfire passed over. His crew, baffled by this unprecedented strategy, refused to follow him. Tragically, 12 men perished while Dodge survived. This disaster illustrates a crucial distinction in how we approach challenges. Most of us operate in one of three mental modes: preacher, prosecutor, or politician. As preachers, we defend our sacred beliefs against challenge. As prosecutors, we look for flaws in others' reasoning. As politicians, we campaign for approval from our audience. Each mode serves a purpose, but all three close us off from rethinking our positions. The alternative is to think like a scientist. Scientists don't defend existing knowledge, they revise it. They don't just seek to prove themselves right, they actively look for ways they might be wrong. This mindset treats knowledge as a hypothesis to be tested rather than a truth to be protected. The scientific approach proves valuable far beyond laboratories. In a study of Italian entrepreneurs, those trained to think scientifically generated over $12,000 in revenue compared to just $300 for the control group. Why? The scientific thinkers pivoted twice as often, abandoning failed hypotheses rather than remaining wedded to original strategies. This difference in thinking explains why BlackBerry, once commanding nearly half the U.S. smartphone market, collapsed to less than 1% by 2014. Co-founder Mike Lazaridis, despite his technical brilliance, dismissed touchscreens and focused exclusively on physical keyboards. When Apple introduced the iPhone, Lazaridis scoffed, "Try typing on a touchscreen without looking at it. Impossible." He remained in preacher mode, defending BlackBerry's approach rather than rethinking it, even as evidence mounted that consumers wanted something different. Intelligence doesn't guarantee adaptability. In fact, being smart can make us more vulnerable to fixed thinking. Studies show that math experts are better at analyzing data only when it doesn't contradict their ideological views. When it does, their analytical skills become liabilities deployed to protect rather than test their beliefs. When Ursula Merquez gradually lost her vision, she insisted she could see despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. This neurological condition, Anton syndrome, reveals a profound truth about human cognition. We all have blind spots that leave us blind to our blindness. This cognitive blindness manifests in the Dunning-Kruger effect, where those with the least knowledge often have the most inflated self-assessments. In one study, participants scoring in the bottom quartile on tests of humor, grammar, and logic estimated themselves to be in the 62nd percentile. The least competent believed they outperformed most peers when they actually ranked near the bottom. This overconfidence appears across cultures, but is most pronounced where management quality is poorest. It creates a dangerous situation where those who most need to improve are least likely to recognize it. The confidence paradox reveals itself in contrasting approaches to leadership. When Halla Tómasdóttir was encouraged to run for Iceland's presidency despite feeling unqualified, she experienced imposter syndrome. Meanwhile, Davi Oddsson, partly responsible for Iceland's economic collapse, confidently ran without relevant qualifications. The sweet spot isn't a Goldilocks balance between confidence and humility, but rather what Grant calls confident humility, believing in your ability while questioning your tools and methods. This allows us to re-examine old knowledge while pursuing new insights. Imposter syndrome, typically viewed as detrimental, can actually provide three benefits. It motivates harder work, encourages smarter work by putting us in a beginner's mindset, and makes us better learners by encouraging us to seek insights from others. In a hospital study, nurses with doubts about their leadership capabilities were more effective leaders because they sought second opinions from colleagues. As Halla discovered during her presidential campaign, imposter feelings can be fuel for growth rather than signs of inadequacy. Rather than waiting for confidence to rise, she built it through achieving challenging goals. Her uncertainty about traditional campaign methods led her to rethink strategies, personally answering social media messages, holding Facebook Live sessions, and running a positive campaign that resonated with voters. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman demonstrates a rare quality, the joy of being wrong. When surprised by research findings, rather than getting defensive, his eyes light up as he exclaims, "That was wonderful! I was wrong!" For Kahneman, discovering he's wrong feels joyful because it means he's learned something new. His secret? He refuses to let beliefs become part of his identity. My attachment to my ideas is provisional. There's no unconditional love for them. This requires two key detachments, separating your present from your past self and detaching opinions from identity. Research shows that feeling detached from past selves can reduce depression over time. As Ray Dalio puts it, if you don't look back at yourself and think, "Wow, how stupid I was a year ago," then you must not have learned much. This approach powers exceptional forecasting. Jean-Pierre Bougomes stands out as an exceptional forecaster who correctly predicted Trump's nomination when experts gave him only 6% odds. What makes great forecasters like Jean-Pierre successful isn't just intelligence, but their willingness to update beliefs frequently. The best forecasters updated predictions 4 times per question, versus the average 2. Treating opinions as hunches rather than facts. Even Jean-Pierre struggled with his Trump prediction, eventually changing his forecast to Clinton when contemplating a Trump presidency kept him awake at night. Rather than being defensive about this error, he freely admits falling victim to desirability bias and even laughs at himself. Being able to laugh at ourselves indicates comfort with being wrong, and research shows people who make fun of themselves tend to be happier. Jean-Pierre's technique involves listing conditions under which he would change his mind about a prediction, preventing attachment to bad forecasts. This approach stands in stark contrast to Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, whose manifesto shows disturbing conviction with no consideration of alternative views or possibility of being wrong. When encountering new information, we have a choice. We can stubbornly attach opinions to our identities or operate like scientists committed to pursuing truth, even if it means proving ourselves wrong. The Wright brothers exemplify productive conflict, having thought together by arguing constantly. Though they shared credit equally for inventing the airplane, their success came not from harmony, but from passionate disagreements that lasted weeks or months. Their father, despite being a bishop, encouraged intellectual debate by including atheist books in his library. This foundation of constructive argument helped the brothers develop courage to fight for ideas and resilience to lose disagreements without losing resolve. Their heated propeller design arguments transformed into productive innovation as they shifted into scientist mode, focusing less on defending positions and more on understanding how different solutions might work. This approach led them to realize they were both wrong, all existing propeller designs were flawed. Their breakthrough came when they invented a revolutionary two-propeller system spinning in opposite directions, functioning like rotating wings. Research across thousands of teams shows that while relationship conflict, personal, emotional clashes, hurts performance, moderate task conflict, debates about ideas and opinions, early in a team's life can boost creativity and decision-making. At Pixar, director Brad Bird deliberately recruited pirates and black sheep for The Incredibles, disagreeable people who questioned established methods. Despite technical leaders claiming the film would require a decade and $500 million, Bird's team of misfits completed it in 4 years while lowering production costs. The key insight is that agreeableness is about seeking social harmony, not cognitive consensus. It's possible to disagree without being disagreeable. The Wright brothers exemplified this dynamic, with typically gentle Orville becoming a good scrapper when working with his more disagreeable brother Wilbur. Grant argues that rethinking requires a challenge network of trusted, disagreeable people who question our assumptions and help overcome blind spots. In a great argument, an adversary isn't a foil, but a propeller, with divergent perspectives allowing thinking to take flight rather than remaining grounded. When trying to persuade others, expert negotiators use several key strategies that differ from average ones. They focus on finding common ground, devoting over a third of their preparation to it, present fewer but stronger reasons rather than diluting their case with weak points, avoid defend-attack spirals by expressing curiosity instead of dismissiveness, and ask more questions. In his debate against Project Debater, an IBM AI, Harish Natarajan won over the audience by emphasizing common ground. He began by stating, "I think we disagree on far less than it may seem," and acknowledged their alignment on the problem of poverty before objecting to subsidies as a solution. This approach demonstrates that changing minds requires showing we're open to changing our own. By conceding good points, we signal we're not preachers or prosecutors with agendas, but scientists seeking truth. As Grant notes, being reasonable literally means that we can be reasoned with. When facing hostility, Grant learned to shift from viewing arguments as wars to treating them as dances. Rather than attacking or retreating when someone becomes hostile, he discovered the power of sidestepping, having a conversation about the conversation itself. After being heckled during a talk about creativity, Grant waited for a break, approached his critic privately, and asked what evidence would change their mind. This technique of showing tranquility in the face of anger often diffuses tension. Grant now believes that having strong opinions weakly held is a mistake. Expressing uncertainty about strongly held views can be more effective. Research shows that moderate confidence is more persuasive than either high or low confidence in courtrooms. When we admit the holes in our arguments and focus on our strongest points, we invite others to join us as partners rather than opponents. As Grant concludes, if we approach an argument as a war, there will be winners and losers. If we see it more as a dance, we can begin to choreograph a way forward. At a Red Sox game, Grant was shocked when 37,000 fans erupted into a "Yankee suck" chant, despite playing against the Oakland A's. This tribal hatred runs so deep that Boston parents teach children to detest anything in pinstripes, and neuroscientists can observe Red Sox fans' brain regions linked to pleasure activate when seeing the Yankees fail. These rivalries extend beyond sports into business and politics, where people don't just identify with their group, but actively disidentify with rivals, defining themselves by what they're not. This prejudice can lead people to harm or cheat rivals, as demonstrated by Ohio State students who were 4 times more likely to lie to University of Michigan students than to students from non-rival schools. How can we overcome such deep-seated prejudices? Grant tried several approaches with baseball fans. Creating an overview effect by having them reflect on their common identity as baseball lovers failed. Humanizing individual rival fans also fell short. When Red Sox fans read a personal story about a Yankees fan, they saw that person as not your typical Yankees fan, an exception, rather than a reason to reconsider their stereotypes. What finally worked was reflecting on the arbitrariness of sports rivalries. When Red Sox and Yankees fans considered how they would support the opposite team if born elsewhere, they selected less spicy hot sauce for rival fans, assigned easier math problems, and were less likely to view the rival's failure as their success. Dismantling stereotypes requires counterfactual thinking, imagining how our beliefs would differ under different circumstances. Questions like, how would your stereotypes be different if you'd been born of another race or in another culture, help people recognize the arbitrary nature of their beliefs. Daryl Davis, a black musician, demonstrates this approach when confronting white supremacists. When a KKK leader claimed black people had criminal genes, Davis cleverly turned the argument around, challenging him to name black serial killers while listing numerous white ones. This planted doubt that eventually led the man to quit the KKK. By approaching supremacists with genuine curiosity, helping them see how their beliefs were inherited rather than reasoned, and building connection through shared interests like music, Davis has helped over 200 white supremacists leave hate groups. One former imperial wizard not only left the KKK, but later asked Davis to be his daughter's godfather. When Marie-Hélène Étienne Rouchot hesitated to vaccinate her premature son Toby, neonatologist Arnaud Gagnon used a radically different approach than most vaccine advocates. Rather than preaching or prosecuting, he interviewed Marie-Hélène with genuine curiosity, asking open-ended questions about her decision not to vaccinate. This approach, motivational interviewing, led Marie-Hélène to not only vaccinate Toby, but also her older children, creating ripples in her anti-vaccination community. The process involves three key techniques: asking open-ended questions, engaging in reflective listening, and affirming the person's desire and ability to change. Studies show remarkable effectiveness. In Arnaud Gagnon's research, after just one motivational interviewing session, mothers were 9% more likely to fully vaccinate their children 2 years later. This approach has been validated in over 1,000 controlled trials worldwide, successfully helping people stop smoking, overcome addictions, improve health behaviors, and even resolve conflicts between separated parents. Betty Begum demonstrated extraordinary listening when she hiked through Ugandan jungles to make peace with warlord Joseph Kony. Rather than preaching or prosecuting, she visited displaced people's camps, announcing she came not to lecture, but to listen. Her patient, non-judgmental attention earned their trust. They called her Megu, mother, despite her representing the government they viewed as oppressors. Research confirms that empathetic, attentive listening makes people less anxious and defensive, encouraging deeper exploration of their views. Great listeners make their audiences feel smart rather than trying to appear smart themselves. When vaccine-hesitant Marie-Hélène expressed concerns about autism, Dr. Arnaud didn't bombard her with facts, but asked about her sources, acknowledged information conflicts, and requested permission before sharing expertise. Listening offers others our scarcest gift, attention. It demonstrates respect and care, making people more willing to consider our perspective. Despite Al Gore's passionate advocacy and an inconvenient truth, by 2018, only 59% of Americans saw climate change as a major threat. The binary framing of the issue as believers versus deniers has contributed to polarization. In reality, there's a spectrum of at least six perspectives on climate change, from alarmed believers to dismissive deniers, with most Americans falling somewhere in between. Coleman's research shows that presenting complex issues as having many shades of gray rather than just two opposing sides dramatically improves the chances of finding common ground. In his experiment, when participants read an article framing gun control as a complex issue with multiple perspectives rather than a binary debate, 100% of pairs were able to draft joint statements on abortion, compared to just 46% who read a both sides article. This demonstrates how complexifying issues disrupts overconfidence cycles and spurs rethinking. When exposed to complexity, people assert fewer opinions, ask more questions, and show twice as much interest in finding common ground as defending their own views. Scientists effectively communicate complexity by including caveats and contingencies in their work. Research shows that news reports that acknowledge limitations of scientific studies maintain reader interest while promoting more flexible beliefs. In polarized discussions, perspective taking, imagining others' views, often fails because we're terrible mind readers. Research shows this approach can actually make us less receptive to rethinking our positions and more confident in our inaccurate judgments. What works better is perspective seeking, actually talking to people to understand their nuanced views. When Christian Cooper refused to make a simple judgment about a racist incident in Central Park, his nuanced assessment expressed mixed emotions and uncertainty, signaling his willingness to rethink the situation and encouraging others to do the same. By recognizing the complex power dynamics of systemic racism rather than making binary judgments, we can foster deeper discussions about justice. Aaron McCarthy, Wisconsin's Teacher of the Year, transformed social studies by cultivating curiosity and encouraging students to question established knowledge. Rather than presenting textbooks as absolute truth, she intentionally assigns outdated materials to demonstrate how historical narratives evolve. Through creative exercises, like writing textbook sections that marginalize boys to help them understand historical exclusion of women, she teaches students to think critically about whose perspectives are included or omitted. Her culminating assignment has eighth graders rewrite textbook chapters to include overlooked historical elements. Despite students reporting greater enjoyment and perceived effectiveness from lectures, research shows they actually learn more from active learning methods. In a physics experiment, students gained more knowledge from active problem-solving sessions than from passive lectures, even though they enjoyed the lectures more. Ron Berger, a public elementary school teacher who moonlighted as a carpenter, built his teaching philosophy around the constant revision of thinking. Rather than beginning with established knowledge, he presented students with grapples, problems to work through individually, then in pairs, and finally as a class. Berger embraced confusion as a catalyst for exploration and required multiple drafts of projects, creating a classroom culture where rethinking was celebrated, not ridiculed. Quality means rethinking, reworking, and polishing, he explained. In organizations, psychological safety proves crucial for learning. When engineer-turned-professor Amy Edmondson studied medical errors, she discovered that teams with psychological safety reported more mistakes but actually made fewer. They simply felt safe enough to admit them. By acknowledging mistakes openly, they could diagnose root causes and prevent recurrences. At the Gates Foundation, experts feared strategy reviews with Bill Gates, whose broad knowledge could expose flaws in their work. This fear discouraged risk-taking, leading teams to propose safe, incremental strategies rather than bold experiments. A more effective approach emerged: managers sharing their past experiences with receiving feedback and their future development goals. By admitting imperfections, they normalized vulnerability and made a public commitment to remain open. In performance cultures, best practices can become frozen in time, preventing ongoing improvement. Process accountability, evaluating how carefully options are considered, creates deeper thinking. At Amazon, important decisions require six-page memos explaining problems, past approaches, and how proposed solutions serve customers. In confronting the question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" we often fall into identity foreclosure, settling prematurely on a career path without proper exploration. Through the story of his cousin Ryan, a neurosurgeon who followed a predetermined path despite growing doubts, Adam Grant illustrates how tunnel vision can lead us to the wrong destination. When we commit to plans that aren't working, we often double down rather than rethink, a pattern called escalation of commitment. This happens because we're constantly searching for self-justifications to soothe our egos and validate past decisions. Ironically, grit, the celebrated combination of passion and perseverance, can have a dark side when it comes to rethinking. Gritty people are more likely to overplay losing hands and persist in impossible tasks. Identity foreclosure affects all kinds of life plans, from career choices to relationships. Once committed, these plans become part of our identity, making it difficult to change course. Students who are most certain about their career paths at 20 often have the deepest regrets by 30 because they haven't done enough rethinking. The solution? Schedule regular career checkups by asking, "When did you form your current aspirations, and how have you changed since? Have you reached a learning plateau?" These questions activate rethinking cycles and help maintain humility about predicting your future. Though happiness is highly valued, from Bhutan's gross national happiness to America's Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness can paradoxically lead to misery. Psychologists find that people who value happiness most are often less happy with their lives and more prone to depression. Rather than searching for jobs that make us happiest, we're better off pursuing work where we can learn and contribute most. Passions are often developed through effort, not discovered. Entrepreneurs' enthusiasm grows with momentum and mastery. As we age, meaning becomes more important, and we find it in actions that benefit others. The evolution of career self-esteem typically progresses from "I'm not important" to "I'm important" to "I want to contribute to something important." Even without major career changes, we can find meaning through job crafting, like hospital custodian Candace Walker, who redefined her cleaning role to include emotionally supporting cancer patients, calling her workplace the House of Hope. Our identities and lives are open systems. We don't need to stay tethered to old images of who we want to be. Rethinking our daily actions with humility, doubt, and curiosity can free us from familiar surroundings and former selves, leading to more fulfilling lives.